Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In the 1998 film The Truman Show, Jim Carrey plays a man who becomes aware that his entire life has been the subject of a reality television show broadcast 24/7 to billions of people worldwide.
Why don't you let me fix you some of this new Mo cocoa drink? All natural cocoa beans from the upper slopes of Mount Nicaragua, no artificial sweeteners.
What the hell are you talking about? Who are you talking to? Tell me what's happening!
Well, you're having a nervous breakdown, that's what's happening.
You're part of this, aren't you?
A few years after the film, psychiatrist Joel Gold, doctor at Bellevue Hospital, began to notice an increasing number of patients convinced that their lives were being similarly filmed and broadcast to the world. He called it the Truman Show delusion and began to explore its particular character and the nature of delusions and psychosis in general with his brother, Ian, a neurophilosopher at McGill. At a time when mental illness is increasingly viewed through the lens of neuroscience and genetics and treated with pharmaceuticals, the Gold brothers explore connections between the development of psychosis and schizophrenia and changes in culture and social life, from bullying to immigration to urban living. It is a new approach to considering the interaction between the brain and the world around us and is covered in a new book called Suspicious Minds: How Culture Shapes Madness. Joel Gold, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Now tell us about that very first patient, Albert. This was back in October of 2003. You describe him as your first Truman Show patient.
Yeah, it was Halloween. I remember pretty clearly a Friday. He was admitted to my unit, and he described his life just as you described it. His life was a reality show. In fact, he mentioned The Truman Show. He said, "My life is like The Truman Show." At the time, I didn't make too much of it. It was fascinating. He had come to New York from out of state. His idea was that if he had come and found that the Twin Towers were still standing, he would know that even the attacks of 9/11 were essentially a put-on for him just to get a reaction for the show. Mm. But if they were in fact destroyed, he would acknowledge that perhaps he was delusional, which is actually somewhat unusual for people to have that insight that they might be ill. When he came to New York, unfortunately for him, he didn't get to the World Trade Center. He got as far as the United Nations, and at that point he decided to seek asylum from the show by going to the UN. A scuffle ensued, and he was brought to Bellevue. Again, I didn't make too much of it, as we see so many fascinating delusions at Bellevue. But over the course of time, I saw more and more of these patients and started connecting the dots. Mm.
More and more people saying, you know, my father is an actor paid to play my father. The people around me are actors. But is this delusion just a new name for an old delusion? Would it have been called something different in the 1950s or 60s?
Absolutely. We looked into this over the course of the writing of the book, and initially, we weren't really sure if this was something new or something that had existed. There's a form and content question, and we discovered that over the course of time, there were only a handful, maybe a dozen forms of delusion: paranoid or persecutory, grandiose, religious, etc. And many people believed, and we came to believe, that over the course of time, as culture changes, so too do the delusions, the content changes. So in the backdrop of the Cold War, for instance, people might have thought that the KGB were after them, or that the CIA had implanted a microchip in their tooth. As we now live in a society of reality television and surveillance, that has now come to fill in the blanks, so to speak, of these kinds of delusions. And initially, we had the thought that it was more of a persecutory and grandiose delusion. As time passed, we came to think of it as more of a delusion of control, wherein people feel like they're not really in control of their own lives.
And we see these kind of cycles of belief of where madness is coming from. Is it spirit? Is it the brain structure? Is it environmental factors? How does this history and those cycles inform your theory?
That's a wonderful question, and absolutely, over the course of time, things have changed. We often think of psychiatry as having started with Sigmund Freud and psychoanalysis and psychotherapy, and then the advent of psychotropic medications in the 60s, 70s, and beyond. But in fact, before that, in ancient times and really up until Freud, it was very much like it is today, very much a biological approach. Something is wrong with the brain. And people would, you know, bore holes in skulls and, you know, the kind of bleeding with leeches approach, that there was something wrong with the humors. Now we've returned clearly with a vengeance to the biological model. And I'm not at all opposed. I worked at Bellevue and I was very comfortable prescribing antipsychotic medication to my patients who were suffering from delusions and hallucinations. But I believe that the pendulum has swung too far in the direction of the biological, both in terms of the cause of psychosis and the treatment. So I think that it's very important not just to look at the biological underpinnings, but the environmental contributors to one developing psychosis, schizophrenia, for instance, and that you can actually do talk therapy of a kind with psychotic individuals and get results. And it's not simply reaching for the prescription pad.
So let's get into that theory. Your theory is that we need to look beyond neurology or genetics to consider psychosis and schizophrenia to cultural or cognitive factors. And this leads to your research into evolutionary psychology, and you come up with this hypothesis about the suspicion system that gives the book its title. So what is the suspicion system? What is its function?
Well, we believe that there's a part of the brain, and we have no particular sense of what the anatomy is, though we might guess at it. But this function is something that evolutionarily has developed in order to act as a kind of an alarm that will detect danger in the environment, particularly social danger. But when that system goes awry, instead of being able to question those initial thoughts, like someone's walking in the forest, if you hear that crack, you quickly turn around. Mm-hmm. Is it an animal that's chasing after me? And you think, no, it's just the wind. That's what we call the reflective system, the slower ability to reflect on that initial impulse. But if that initial impulse doesn't shut down, it becomes hypertrophy to the point where it really is now a delusion that's very firmly held.
So the system that we as human beings have to fear the Bengal tiger, I guess, in the woods,
right,
suddenly factors in our whole place inside of a social structure.
Yeah. In times long ago, people lived in, you know, villages, small towns, and there's some research that suggests that our brain is only able to really fit about 125 or 150 people in there. And what I mean by that is, if you live in a small town with about 100, 150 people, you pretty much know most of the people in it, if not all of them. And so you can feel a little bit more comfortable. But as cities grow in number, there are more unknown others. And when there are unknown others, there's a sense that they may mean to do us harm. And so this system becomes more important in a sense. And there is evidence that the larger the city one lives in, the greater the incidence of psychosis and schizophrenia. It's actually well established, much like living in a large city might put one at higher risk for lung cancer because the air is not as clean. People don't really know about this, including psychiatrists and psychiatric researchers, that certain environmental factors such as living in an urban environment, being an immigrant, or being a survivor of child abuse makes one higher at higher risk for developing psychosis later in life. And these are, again, environmental factors, much like smoking cigarettes is for lung cancer and heart disease.
What is the role of culture in influencing delusions, psychoses, or schizophrenia? Joel Gold and his brother Ian have been researching that very topic and the incidence of something they call the Truman Show delusion. It's covered in a new book called Suspicious Minds: How Culture Shapes Madness. You're looking at delusions as a malfunctioning response to a social environment, right?
Absolutely.
What is the relationship to that and the Truman Show delusion? What purpose does that serve?
If things feel not quite right, one has to be on their guard. Again, like the Bengal tiger you referenced, if there are all of these people and they seem a bit strange, I don't know, they're looking at me, they're making signs, maybe there's something going on here. And then perhaps you see or remember the movie, it inflames the suspicion system, so to speak. And instead of, oh, I don't know, maybe I'm just having a strange day, I didn't get a good night's sleep. If someone has, again, these risk factors, suddenly they may be using the Truman Show effect to act as a kind of scaffolding for their feelings. But if we become so much on guard that we're not able to step out of it, we have these persecutory ideas. And then for, again, a number of these younger people, late teens, early 20s, who may be inching into psychosis, the Truman Show might resonate with them in a sense, and they say, yes, this is my life. And it's very hard to move them out of that.
Joel, very early in the book, you say that you are seeking some balance in the conversation about the role that genetics and neurobiology play as compared to experience, culture, society, environment. But I know in my life and probably the lives of many others, there are people close to us with mental illness, and in many ways, acknowledging the role of biology and genetics destigmatizes, depersonalizes, takes away this sense of fault or shame. So what's the balance in that conversation?
Oh, I think that's such an important point. For many years, particularly during the height of psychoanalytic theory, there was the notion of the schizophrenogenic mother, the cold, uncaring, aggressive mother who would actually induce schizophrenia in their child. And for many years, this was obviously not true and very, very painful for families who were either enraged because they knew it wasn't the case, that they were loving parents, loving siblings, or intense guilt. What did I do? Maybe I should have done this or that and my child would be well. So in that regard, the biolization of psychosis and schizophrenia was a wonderful thing for those patients and their families. At the same time, it would be irresponsible of us to recognize that there are environmental factors. Most families of schizophrenic patients have loving, wonderful families, but that's not to say that there aren't, unfortunately, some kids who are severely abused, and those kids who are abused are at higher risk. So we're not painting everyone with a broad brush, but that's just the fact. But we want to make it clear we're not suggesting that because we want to look at the environment and culture that we're pointing fingers at family members. If someone lives in an urban environment and therefore, you know, including myself, you're in New Hampshire, I'm in New York, and in that sense I'm at higher risk for developing schizophrenia than you are, one could say, well, am I being unfair to my kids by choosing to live in a large city? Perhaps I should move to, you know, a bucolic town and lower their risk. But most of us don't do that. And so we have to live in the world in which we do. And I think this is something that very, very challenging for families and for patients.
Joel Gold, thank you so much for joining us.
Great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Joel Gold and his brother Ian have together written a book called Suspicious Minds, How Culture Shapes Madness. There's much more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Up next, we're going to hear from someone whose days are consumed by television, New York Times TV critic Neil Genslinger, who makes a case for ignoring studies about TV watching. Is it good for you? Is it bad for you? Does it matter? We'll discuss after the break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Last month, the American Heart Association released a report indicating that adults who watch TV for 3 or more hours each day are twice as likely to die at a younger age. As alarming as that headline may be for the average viewer, imagine if it were your job to watch hours and hours of television every day. The New York Times film critic Neil Gunslinger says that from here on out, he's turning his back on the confusing world of research about TV habits. And you should, too. Neil, great to have you on Word of Mouth.
Thanks.
Okay, so a report begins. A new study finds that watching TV could... What's your first thought? Run in the other direction?
That is pretty much my first thought, especially with this new study, which essentially said watching TV will kill you. That's particularly alarming to read that for someone who watches TV for a living.
Well, you've got to understand the impulse. I mean, we'd like to know how something as habitual as TV is affecting our lives, right?
It's true. My personal feeling is that television has kind of entered the phase that some other things are already in, things like food. I haven't eaten in years because I can't keep track of which foods are good for you this week and which foods are not good for you. So the only thing to do is just to stop eating. It seems like there's a new study every week or every couple of weeks on their effects, and they're so ingrained in our lives anyway that it's not as if they're going to disappear. So you can either spend your whole life trying to keep track of these studies, or you can just try to use common sense, which is what I've decided to go with from now on.
Well, I've always wondered how TV critics find time to see so many programs. So what do you guess on average? How much television do you watch for your job?
How much do I personally watch?
Yes.
So, 5 hours a day anyway.
So should I just clarify, you're not overweight, have diabetes, or a teen mom?
I am none of those things. I weigh 148 pounds, and when I'm not watching TV, I run half marathons. So that's my version of common sense. I watch a lot of TV, but I try to actually get some exercise when I'm not watching TV, and that's really what this new study is telling people. You can't sit on the couch all day, every day, and expect to be healthy, and you shouldn't need a study to tell you that.
Okay, I know you said you'd like to steer clear of these, but I wonder if I could get your take on some of the TV-based research headlines from the past couple of years. Can we go through some of those?
Sure.
Okay, TV, a sleep detriment in children study finds. Any thoughts?
I have a couple of children, and sometimes they didn't sleep well. I'm not sure how that study pinned that on television as opposed to on a million other things that could be going on in a child's head. Kids are complicated machines, and it's hard to imagine that a single thing like television is responsible for everything that's wrong with them or everything that's right with them. That's the thing about these studies. They sometimes contradict one another. You can find a study that says television makes kids stupider, but you can also find a study that says television makes kids smarter.
Okay, how about TV in the bedroom equals better sex, study finds?
I'm not sure I've seen that one, but I'd like to. I suppose it could be possible. Depends on the couple, I would think. And
I'm guessing the viewing as well.
Yes, and what they're watching. Johnny Carson, of course, used to make that. That was a running joke, you know, about children that had been conceived because he was boring people too much and they decided to stop watching, that kind of stuff.
So, Neil, what if you were a researcher looking at the effects of television on people's lives? What would you study?
I am more interested in the positive effects of television, and not because I'm trying to boost television, but I particularly think of my mother, who is 94 years old, still gets around, but not that much. Watches some fair amount of TV to keep engaged. She'll want to talk about whatever the latest show is. For people like that, television is, is a good thing. I think it's a lifeline. It's a way to stay connected, and broadening the cultural horizons of people is an important function for television. I think 100 years ago, you lived in your little town or whatever, and you really didn't know a lot about what other people, other races, other religions thought or felt. film, radio, and certainly now television has broken down a lot of those barriers. Some people might think that's a negative. I don't. I think it's a positive. I think exposure to the world is a positive thing.
Well, Neil, you'll be very pleased to note that we just discovered Pacific Standards has a headline at this moment, "Can TV Improve Your Health?" So,
well, there you go.
Here we go. The backs and the fours. Neil Gensinger, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet.
Neil Gensinger, TV critic for The New York Times. He also reviews films and theater on occasion. You'll find a link to read his article, Why the Research on Viewing is Best Ignored, along with a list of our favorite contradictory television studies. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, Neil Gensinger is an unapologetic TV binge watcher. Up next, our very own producer Taylor Quimby admits to something many people would find embarrassing, all in the name of saving money. A shameless confession about undergarments. That's after the news.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. There are all sorts of ways people save on clothing, by comparing prices, using coupons, taking advantage of membership discounts, shopping online, or buying used. You name it. But there is one cost-cutting strategy people don't boast about. Producer Taylor Quimby has more.
I've got a little confession to make. For about 3 years now, I've been wearing boys' underwear. Not toddler-sized briefs with Iron Man or Thomas the Tank Engine plastered on the butt. I'm talking about plainly colored, brand-name, boys, extra-large boxer briefs. Scoff if you have to, but if you saw me in my skivvies, I guarantee you would have no idea. Just ask my wife.
If I didn't tell you one of these was boys and one of these were men, and you didn't...
I would never know. I would never know if I had to guess.
For most brands, a pair of XL boys' undies have a waist size of 28 to 30, which is exactly the same as what I used to wear, a men's small. As far as I can tell, they are, design-wise, nearly identical. In fact, the only place I can feel or see a difference is my wallet.
You don't get, like, two more or one more?
Yeah, so the men's are $12.99, the boys are $9.99, and you get
How
one
more
pair.
Are you serious?
Yeah. I mean, you have to be a 28 to 30. But this is the gray zone where the waist is exactly the same.
For years, I was too embarrassed to share my cash-saving strategy with the rest of the world. But recently, I decided to come out of the proverbial changing room and see who else out there has been shopping in the kids section.
Whenever I'm looking for something that I think I could get, like this lovely rain jacket that I have on actually is a boys large because it was probably $50 less than the adult.
What brand is it?
It's North Face, I think. Yeah, North Face.
That's my friend Sarah Palermo, who at 4'11 occupies the same sort of retail gray zone as I do.
Pants, because I'm super short.
That's another friend of mine, Aaron Stewart.
Also for socks and like pajamas, that kind of thing. For me, it's more pants just because of the height thing. And I'm just short in general, so shirts also tend to fit a little bit better and don't sag, and the sleeves aren't really long.
And that's not all. My sister-in-law buys kids Red Sox and Patriots gear. My cousin Riley buys kids shoes. Amy buys kids winter gear. My mom wears kids hats. All in all, more than a dozen people I know ponied up to buying kids clothing of some kind or another. And yes, most of them are slim or petite, but not to the degree you might think. Ed Gribben has an explanation. He's president of Alvinon, a company that does research around how clothes fit and advises brands on sizing measurements.
Over the last approximately 30 years, brands and retailers have tended to increase the sizes of their clothing so dramatically that in women's wear, what used to be a size 8 in 1978 is today considered a size 0.
In other words, the average American is getting bigger, and retail brands are modifying their clothing lines to match. It's a trend the industry calls vanity sizing.
But they're not offering any more sizes. So the people who are at the smaller end of the size scale are somewhat disenfranchised. They can't find clothes that fit them. My daughter and my wife are two cases in point. They go out shopping and they both wear about a size 2 or a size 0, and many brands don't offer those sizes.
But like me, not everybody buys because they can't find adult options that fit. Bargain hunting can be a total thrill, and shoppers love the feeling that they know something other consumers don't.
I guess, do you get a feeling of, satisfaction when you go up to the checkout counter.
Yeah, yeah, it's definitely a little rush, a little bit of glee knowing that you're kind of gaming the system a little bit. It makes up for having to use a stool to get stuff in the kitchen. It's one little victory for short people.
So I guess the question is, why not buy kid-sized clothes? To answer that, I want to go back to that conversation I had with my wife.
If I didn't tell you one of these was boys and one of these were men,
and you didn't... I would never know. I would never know if I had to guess.
Like, if you met me, though, and you were just, like, doing my laundry...
And I just looked at the label, and I was like, what the f***? Oh, sorry. Whoops.
But that would totally be your reaction, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think at first you're like, what the f*** is going on here?
There you have it. That's why not to buy kids' underwear. Here's neuropsychologist Dr. David Lewis.
So much of our shopping is done more or less on autopilot. So we kind of have a set routine of steps in our shopping program, and we follow them almost blindly.
Lewis explains that anything that interrupts our shopping autopilot can stop a potential sale in its tracks. A long line, a rude salesperson, even a tiny white tag stamped with the letter B instead of M.
You see this pair of pants, for example, and it's... You think, oh, that's great, and it's a great price. And then you see, oh, it's labeled for boys. That would introduce a disrupt to your thinking. You then have to actually switch to your more conscious parts of your brain to actually say, well, do I actually want to wear something which is actually for kids when I'm no longer a kid?
For women, I suspect this isn't as big a disrupt as it is for men. Fitting into children's clothes may even be a point of pride for some who've recently lost weight or snagged a particularly good deal. Not so for guys. Owen Islin was once shopping with his daughter at a used kids' clothing store when he stumbled upon a pair of corduroys.
Went into the adjacent fitting room to my daughter's fitting room, and, I mean, coming out, there was definitely some looks. I think I was probably the first man ever to try anything on in that store.
Of the dozen or so people that came forward for this story, Owen was the only man to admit to buying kids' clothes. But when I got him on tape, I discovered that the pants in question weren't even technically for kids.
I wear a 33, 32.
They were just being sold at a used clothing store on a rack labeled young men. And he was still pretty clearly embarrassed about it.
I'm not sure I would try something on again in the same store, knowing the reaction I would probably get, you know. Sort of felt like I got caught doing something. I don't know.
My theory? Men feel too emasculated by the prospect of buying clothes for children. They'd rather pay more for the adult alternative. For me, making the leap wasn't easy, but when faced with that cognitive disrupt that Dr. Lewis just described, I found myself asking a question. Would I rather be thought of as a prudent shopper or someone willing to spend extra to feel more like a man? The irony, of course, is that I'm wearing boys' underwear right now, and nobody would ever know the difference if I didn't say so on the radio. For Word of Mouth, I'm Taylor Quimby.
Do I have to say what I think it is right now?
Well, I just wanted to know if you had a guess.
No, I don't want to guess yet. I think they look good on you. That's not part of it, though, right?
Taylor had no luck finding other men who would admit to purchasing kid-sized clothing, but surely he is not alone. Who among you is willing to come forward and confess to wearing boy-sized briefs, pants, or tees? We're taking confessions on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, or on our listener line at 603-223-2448. 603-223-2448. And you may remain as anonymous as you wish. For now, we're going to continue looking at more diminutive beings, our small feathered friends. Summer bird watching in New England when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Whether it be swarms of seagulls squawking along the shore or a cheerful goldfinch hopping delicately from branch to branch, summer is a bountiful time for birds in New England. But for bird watchers, not all winged creatures are created equal. Joining me now to shed some light on the reviled, respected, and rare birds of summer is Eric Masterson, protection specialist with the Harris Center for Conservation Education, also author of Birdwatching in New Hampshire, Hampshire. That is a hyper-local guide to the best birding spots and events the state has to offer. Eric, so great to have you back with us.
Great to be here, Virginia.
So we'll get into the rare birds in a bit, but let's just start with a bird that is easy to spot, the seagull. First, why is there so little love for the seagull?
Well, the seagull, I would stop you right there. I mean, it's an amazing family that has diversified across the planet from pole to pole and around everywhere else in between. And in New Hampshire, we have 18 species in the state. So seagulls as some sort of monolith doesn't happen. So there's a lot of different seagulls. But the ones I think you're probably referring to that I wouldn't call them reviled, but maybe not cherished would be the large white-headed gulls, the blackbacks and the herring gulls. They're the ones that people see on rubbish dumps. And if you're out on the beach,
They might nip in and steal your cookies.
So I think folks are thinking of those. And that's really two species of, as I say, 18. Now, some of those 18 would be rare, but there's quite a number that occur regularly in the state. And some, I mean, I'll give you an example of how that thinking can lead us astray. One of the biggest mass migrations of birdwatchers in the history of birdwatching in this country was in 1975 when a rare seagull was spotted in Newburyport. And birders from all over the country, thousands of people descended on Newburyport. It was on the news and papers and column inches were replicated everywhere. It was a remarkable event because this was a beautiful gull. It was a pink blush underneath called a Ross's gull. And it was from the Arctic and it was an exotic bird. And so gulls are, it's a many-faceted family of birds. So there's a couple of species that I think we think of as offenders, so to speak.
All right, so no more lumping together.
No more lumping, no.
Let's walk through some of the birds that we can spot throughout the state and New England, region by region. And we'll start with the seacoast.
So, right, the seacoast. Well, on gulls in the seacoast, clearly the place to see gulls, by and large, is the seacoast. And the place in New Hampshire where they breed is on the Isle of Shoals. And actually, they're declining there, the seagulls, possibly because landfills are being closed. There's very few landfills left in the country, left in New Hampshire, that are still operational. And the ones that are operational have active practices to discourage the gulls. So seagulls are declining. So you'll still see plenty of them. But right now in July, we're actually, this sounds strange, but we're actually seeing the beginning of fall migration.
In July?
Now, I know people are heading to Hampton Beach with their kids and their surfboards, and they don't want to hear that fall is upon us. But for birds, some Arctic breeding shorebirds are already heading south for the fall. The males that have gone north to the tundra, have done their business, and now they're heading south, and non-breeding fail breeders would be heading south too. So on the coast now, you'll be seeing shorebirds heading south in increasing numbers through July and early August.
Any in particular that you'd be looking out for?
Oh, there's about 30 species that occur in the state, so lots. Short-billed dowitches are a common one, both lesser and greater yellowlegs. Small peeps. Peeps are a group of quite hard to identify small shorebirds that might be a little bigger than a sparrow. And so you see huge flocks of those in the Hampton Harbor area.
How about offshore? You mentioned the Isles of Shoals, but how about on the water itself?
This is a great time to take a whale watch. And I come, as you know, and you can probably hear my accent, I come from Ireland. And whale watching in Ireland is a really tough endeavor because the seas are rough. We get the full force of the Atlantic, and you've got to go really far out to see whales. This place we are in here, the New England coastline, is one of the best places on the planet to see whales, and you only have to go out 20 miles. It's a half-day trip. There are many operators in Rye and Hampton Harbor that take you out, and it's a half-day trip. And in addition to the whales, there are seabirds now that come in the summer, and they come from places as far up as Tristan da Cunha. There's a species of petrel, Wilson storm petrel, that's visiting us. It breeds. This has got the neatest life history of many bird species. It has its breeding in the southern seas, basically off the Antarctic continent. And then it comes north for a second summer. It doesn't have a winter. So it's up here now, and you can see those out on the Jeffrey's Ledge, which is about 20 miles off the coast.
What do they look like?
They're small. They're about the size of a swallow, and they're black. They're entirely black with a white rump. And they're called petrels because they have this feeding habit where they dance along the surface of the water, picking little food items from the surface of the water, krill and so forth. And the word petrel is a derivation of St. Peter because of the biblical accounts of St. Peter walking on water.
Oh.
And so the word petrel is a derivation of that because they appear to be walking on water.
Okay, so how about let's head further inland up to the North Country. What kind of birds might we be seeing in the North Country?
July is tough if you're in the woods, and the North Country's got woods, because birds now, they're finished singing in July, because singing is good if you're setting out a territory or if you're attracting a mate, but if you're trying to avoid predators, then you don't want to be calling around saying, I'm here, I'm here, I'm here. So birds are quiet and they're feeding young. So now's a good time to, if you're interested in proving breeding and Atlas projects and breeding bird survey projects that try to document breeding, do so in the late summer when you can prove breeding. You can either see an adult carrying food or you can see a juvenile, you can find a nest. So there are a couple of species that New Hampshire Audubon is particularly interested in. They're declining species, rusty blackbird and olive-sided flycatcher, and they're both North Country specialists. And so anyone who's really got an interest in this, it'd be a great time to go out and see if you could find rusty blackbird and olive-sided flycatcher and prove them breeding and let Audubon know.
How do they know? Just posting it on their website?
Well, you can either do it through eBird, which is eBird.org, which is now the it's become now an international portal for entering bird sightings. And it's really quite simple and free to set up an account there. And if you can't do that, just call Audubon, and Becky Swamler would be the person to talk to there to let her know if you're not able to navigate eBird. But it's really quite an easy thing to do. It's a great website.
Eric Masterson is with us. He's protection specialist with the Harris Center for Conservation Education. He's also the author of the Bird Watching in New Hampshire book. How about those of us who love to be by a lake, lakes region? What kind of birds might we sight in that area?
Well, lakes now, we're really in the heart. We don't have migrants passing through the state so much. So really what we have now are birds that are resident for the summer, birds that have come here to breed. And lakes really, you're talking about the breeding species of lakes, which are loons. We don't have too many water birds. If you wanted waterfowl, probably the best place in New Hampshire is a lake on Bagog. You can also see in summer, you can see, again, failed breeders that may have come from somewhere else. They may breed somewhere else. They fail to breed, and so they tend to wander during the summer months, like the Caspian tern that was seen 2 days ago on Lake Massabesic. And that's really odd, really quite rare in the area, but it occurred because it was probably, I don't know if it was a failed breeder or for whatever reason, but you get these wandering seabirds sometimes, in the interior of the state that can show up on lakes. But by and large, there's not a lot to be seen on lakes this time of year.
For those lucky enough to spot a rare bird this summer, any surprising sightings so far?
Well, regionally, it was really quite remarkable. There was an ancient murrelet spotted in Vermont, in Shelburne, Vermont. There was a tufted puffin spotted in Machias. And they're both they're common on the West Coast. They're a Pacific seabird. If you only occur on the sea and you only occur in the Pacific, how do you get to the Atlantic? And so really, first time either of them were seen, first time the murrelet was seen in Vermont, first time the tufted puffin was seen in one of the very few tufted puffin records for the Atlantic Ocean. And so the thinking is maybe with the retreat of the ice in the Northwest Passage that there's now possibly, and this is pure speculation, but possibly there's now more of a route, not that this is going to become a deluge, but there's more of an ability for these birds to get to the eastern seaboard than there was before. So really, that was remarkable. In New Hampshire, there's been a few odd birds, nothing stunning. The one summer sighting that really is remarkable and is continuing is the nesting of Mississippi kites in Newmarket. And that's been happening since 2008. And they're really, they don't breed north of the Mason-Dixon. They're a southern raptor. And in 2008, a nesting pair, two pairs actually, were found nesting in the Newmarket area. And it's not a secret where they are. They're in the Gonnet Road area. And so it's really quite a remarkable thing. And they've been nesting there every year since. And so it's a good place to go and spot them.
Any theories as to why they are north of the Mason-Dixon line? Is it similar? Possible speculation of climate change?
I'm not aware of any data that would link that unequivocally, but they are expanding their range. And, you know, populations aren't stable. Even birds that have healthy populations, you know, vary around a point. They don't remain stable. They're, you know, always going up or going down. And so the Mississippi kites have actually been expanding their range now for several years. And so we're way farther north of their established range, so it's an outlier. I really can't explain it. It's quite a remarkable sighting.
Well, Eric Masterson, thank you so much for the tips, and I feel a little bit better about seagulls right now, so thanks.
You're welcome.
Eric Masterson, production specialist with the Harris Center for Conservation Education. He's also author of Birdwatching in New Hampshire. And if you'd like to see a list of New Hampshire summer birds broken down region by region, you'll find it on our website, wordofmouthradio.org, along with ebird.org and the contacts that Eric mentioned at Audubon. Sometimes spotting birds is as easy as looking out your window. And if you feed them, well, they are bound to keep coming back. Phil Kyle is senior naturalist at the Thornton Burgess Greenbrier Nature Center in Sandwich, Massachusetts. Each morning, he ventures into the thicket behind his office to feed and connect with his feathered friends.
This morning, like every day, I get about a scoop of black oil sunflower seed and a scoop of cracked corn. And that usually holds them over till the next morning. Usually. Birds were coming from, you know, miles away to come to this feeder. Okay. So I'm just scattering the cracked corn on the ground here for the ground feeders. We're only about 20 feet away from the other tube feeder and suet. And then I put the black oil sunflower seed in the tube feeder. There we go. Okay. So I think they're keeping their distance a little bit just because they're not that hungry right this second. A lot of people, unfortunately, hang their bird feeder where they can see it. Of course, they say, well, why don't I have any birds at my feeder? When you're out in the open and there are no leaves in the trees, the birds are concerned about predators like hawks, and they won't come. But right here, they feel really comfortable because they can go right into the thicket and disappear. The white-throated sparrow is on the ground, but other than that, the fact that we're here... Oh, there's a tree sparrow right there. Some of the white-throated sparrows are literally about 10 feet away from us on the ground, so they're already, you know, saying, we don't care if you're here or not, we're just coming after this cracked corn anyway. It's so exciting to hear what I hear right now. If you listen, if you know what to listen for, you can actually tell what the birds are doing. You just see him on the top there. A red-bellied woodpecker right up in the tree. Yeah, that's the drumming. That is as a result of the declination of the sun. It's triggered the testosterone in this male to attract mates. This particular woodpecker has given up coming to the sewage, which is about 5 feet away, and has chosen to drum instead. And other birds, like that one right there, that chickadee, was upset. He was giving me a chickadee-dee-dee-dee, say, get away here, you're making me nervous, you're too close to the food. Most people, when they go out their backyard, they fill their feet or whatever, they hear the chickadees going, chickadee-dee-dee-dee-dee. They just, oh, this chickadee is glad to see me, or they remember the last time I was out here. But what it's doing is actually it's scolding you. It's saying, get away from my food supply. Get the heck out of here. And so whenever I reveal this to most people, they don't want to believe me. But just walking closer to a bird feeder, that the chickadees will eventually scold us. I see a sparrow, a song sparrow at the tub feeder. I can't believe this. See, the song sparrows are usually on the ground or on the platform feeder right there, but up at the tub feeder. This is very strange behavior. And I just think that what happens is they are not intimidated by us. That's good. I mean, that's what I hope for, is that the birds say, okay, he's a naturalist, let him go, he's okay. That's what I hope.
And that piece was produced by Sarah Reynolds. Well, that about does it for today. We're so grateful for your listening time. In case you missed it, earlier today, producer Taylor Quimby admitted to something, well, kind of personal.
For about 3 years now, I've been wearing boys' underwear.
To be clear, Taylor rolls up with a size 28 to 30-inch waist, so he buys boys-size skivvies to save money. A number of women he talked to admitted to wearing kid-size clothing, but no men went on record as shopping in the junior leagues. So we'd like to hear from you. Do you run small? Do you wear kid-size briefs, pants, or T-shirts? You can confess anonymously on our listener line at 603-223-2448. 603-223-2448. 2448 or come out on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. After all, the littlest secrets travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We invite all comers of all sizes to join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.